Domestic violence crisis and Spears welcomed back. Hello, I'm Stephen Clark with the latest from NIRS News. Domestic violence is a crisis in this country, the Minister for Women has said, in the wake of another murder in New South Wales. A 28-year-old childcare worker was found dead at her home in the regional town of Forbes on Monday. The man charged with her murder was on bail for several violent charges against the same victim. Speaking to the ABC, Senator Katie Gallagher says women don't feel safe.
I think anybody who has women in their lives acknowledges, I think how women feel about this in particular. And, when we see, it's not safe to go out for a run, you go shopping, you take action against violent perpetrators, you do all the right things, and we still have these cases.
Four spears taken by Captain James Cook on his arrival in the country have been returned to the community they were stolen from. In a ceremony held at Trinity College in Cambridge, the four spears were permanently repatriated to the La Perouse Aboriginal community. They're all that remain of 40 spears that Cook recorded as having been taken from the Gweagal people of the Dharawal Nation. They'll be put on display at a new visitor centre, which will be built at Kurnell in Sydney's south. Ray Ingray is the director of the Gajaga Foundation, which worked with communities to negotiate the spears' return.
1770, there was violence and those spears were stolen. We're mature enough to open those conversations up. You've got journals that talk about the violence that occurred on that day and the theft of those spears. This is the tangible evidence that this happened.
Caden Williams-Riley is a descendant of a Gweagal man who tried to fight off the British explorers.
It shows that, through trials and tribulations, we can persevere through anything and, even to this day, we're resilient and we're willing to, right the wrongs of history.
A New York court has heard that an American tabloid newspaper suppressed negative stories about Donald Trump during the 2016 presidential election campaign. On day two of Mr. Trump's hush money trial, prosecutors questioned former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker for nearly 3 hours. Mr. Pecker revealed he'd met with Mr. Trump and his lawyer and agreed to promote positive stories about him during the campaign. Prosecutors are trying to prove that Mr. Trump influenced the 2016 election result by preventing damaging information about a sex scandal from coming out in the days before polls opened. Mr. Trump later slammed a court-imposed gag order and said the legal proceedings were benefiting Joe Biden.
I'm not allowed to defend myself, and yet other people are allowed to say whatever they want about me. Very, very unfair.
We'll have more after this.
When someone was sharing intimate images without my permission and threatening me online, I didn't know what to do. One of my aunties told me about the online safety laws and helped me report the abuse to esafety.gov.au. The laws help to keep people safe from severe online abuse and help to remove dangerous online content. Go to esafety.gov.au to learn more or to report online abuse. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
Program sponsor.
Road deaths across Australia have surged in the past 12 months. The Australian Automobile Association says fatal road accidents across the nation have jumped by 8.2%, with 1,286 fatalities year on year to the end of March. New South Wales had the biggest rise in road deaths over the year to 364 fatalities. Victoria had a 13% increase to 291 deaths, while the Northern Territory had a 21% surge. Meanwhile, the ACT had the steepest drop in road deaths, followed by Tasmania. Communications Minister Michelle Rowland has emphasised the National Regulator for Online Safety is exercising its power under Australian law, as a federal court case against social media platform X returns to court today. eSafety wants extreme violent video content relating to an alleged Sydney terror attack deleted from worldwide view. But X has only geo-blocked the content for Australian web users. Ms. Rowland told the ABC the government believes the stabbing video depicts real violence that would likely cause offence.
In this case, the very high degree of impact is reached by virtue of the terrorism designation that has been given to this particular event.
To stay up to date with NIRS News, follow us on Twitter or Instagram, like us on Facebook and visit our website at nirs.org.au. And that's the latest National Indigenous News.
For National Indigenous Radio Service, for voices of our people.
Did you know that drinking any alcohol while you're pregnant can harm your bub? It's hard to stop drinking, but if you choose to drink alcohol while you're pregnant, it can leave your bub with all sorts of problems that can last their whole life. Remember, pregnancy and grog don't mix. If you need to yarn about it, visit your local Aponipama clinic and wellbeing centre. We're here to help. Our health and our bubba's health is in our hands.
Station sponsor.
What do you want to do for the rest of your life? Nobody knows that. Question is, what do you want to do next?
Practical courses.
With flexible choices.
Start a diploma to start earning faster.
Open up pathways to a uni degree. Do what feels right for right now at TAFE Queensland. Apply now. RTO 0275 PRV 13003.
Station sponsor.
And welcome to Blackmore Tribal Edition. Murumu here with you as we travel across the multiverse via the Yidinji Broadcast Service and our friends, of course, at Bumper Bipper Media 98.7 FM, because they take this message to the Commonwealth of Australia via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And joining me today is the Attorney General for the Sovereign Yidinji Government, Ganyara Yalmabara, and the Minister for Education and Social Affairs, Yurilam Guruminya. And today we'll be discussing, I guess, what people label the frontier wars. And Ganyara, we'll start off with you. That obviously Anzac Day is a very big day for Australia, New Zealand and everyone else that was involved with those war efforts, including a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families who were fighting for the empire, for example, prior to 1901 and then post-1901 for the Commonwealth, a very important role and responsibility with defence and things like that, and we're very big supporters of that. The interesting thing, though, is that prior to those events, things happened on this continent and on the Yidinji territory that people might describe them as frontier wars, but really they were massacres and genocide committed against the Yidinji Nation and many other tribes.
Yeah, look, it really was. You know, there was a lot of, I would call it just straight out massacre and murder, just brutality at its worst. You know, the British really showed their true colours on how they can wipe out peoples, you know, and they've done a very good job of it in Australia. They nearly wiped out the Aboriginal people. They actually considered them a dying race. But yes, it was massacres and murders. By international standards, it would have been called genocide. So yeah, it was very large, very huge. Yidinji got hit very hard with it. They got really knocked around. And when you start to look at the names, you know, Skeleton Creek, wonder why they call that place Skeleton Creek, or, you know, Bones Knob. I wonder why they call that Bones Knob, you know. What was the real meaning behind all these sort of names, you know? So that's something that most people are very unaware of. Why would you call it Skeleton Creek? There were skeletons everywhere. And whose were they? They weren't cattle. You know, they weren't wallaby skeletons. They were Aboriginal people. They were Yidinji skeletons in there. Why were they calling it Bones Knob? You know, it wasn't because there were kangaroo bones at the bottom. They were the Aboriginal people. The Yidinji people were told to jump off, you know, or we'll shoot you over the edge. You know, it was a cliff up in the Atherton Tablelands. And if you don't jump, we'll shoot you. So we'll get over there one way or the other. So this is the brutality of the, I suppose, the British Empire when it was here. So it's something that most people don't know, and they've got to be very considerate of it, because it wasn't a war. A war is when you declare war on someone and you let them know we're going to declare war on you officially. And then with every war, you know, after every war is a declaration of peace. Now, we actually wrote off to the Australian government going back, 12 or 13 years ago, said, OK, look, if there was this war, you know, which is a conquest, when was the declaration of peace actually called, you know, because we haven't seen it. Are we still at war or there? And we know it wasn't a war, because the High Court and the Mabo determination said it was not conquest, it was an act of settlement.
Yeah, so interesting. I mean, look, at the end of the day, they can label it what they like. The cold, hard facts are that foreigners came to this territory and attempted to eliminate the Yidinji people, and they didn't do it. So whether it was a war or not, they failed. And the conquest didn't happen because you didn't just still here today, they're here tomorrow, and they're here forevermore because, you know, the one that created the Yolngu nation cannot be defeated. And in his wisdom, Gaiabara, God, has looked after us and now has provided us this opportunity to remedy.
Well, just on a side note with this, you know, normally with an act of conquest, you're in an action of conquest, which is war, the winning side actually have the right to get rid of the laws of the existing people who were there first, you know. And but didn't the Uluru Statement come out recently, only, what, 6-7 years ago, and said, oh, no, look, sovereignty was never ceded and it wasn't extinguished. It couldn't be extinguished because there was no war. So it was an act of settlement. It wasn't war. So I'm trying to get everyone to get away from the use of the word frontier wars. Just let's go to genocide, the frontier genocide and the frontier massacres. They sound a lot better to me.
Yeah, so Yirrkala, obviously this is a very important time. How does one... obviously the Anzac Day commemorations are held in Australia and are very much revered by a majority of Australians. And how does one introduce the Yidinji perspective to Australians when... there's this solemn moments of silence and remembering those who have given their lives for the protection of Australia, let's say.
Yeah, well, you know, you can understand that someone acting within their beliefs to, you know, fight for something that they do believe in is, you know, worthy of being respected. But, you know, for the most part, anything that happened in the way of wars, as far as the Australian legal government goes, was mostly overseas. You know, there was a bit of violence up in the Northern Territory in Darwin and that sort of thing. But for the most part, it was all outside of Australian waters. Very different for the first people, the First Nations of this country in the 1700s and the 1800s, where as Gunyara pointed out before, these things were happening, this genocide, these massacres were happening all within the borders of their countries. And, you know, I think of it from a schooling perspective, to have children learning about these things in history. It's not something in the far distant, somewhere overseas. It's something in the backyard, something that happened right here where we are in Yidinji. As Gunyara pointed out, you know, the creeks around here where skeletons were dumped, the points where people were either pushed off. And, you know, I've had stories where, you know, people are alive today because they've landed on the bodies of their parents who were pushed over before them. You know, it's a horrific story that, you know, like you said, war seems to have some sort of chivalrous sort of tone to it. This was none of that. This was just horror.
Yeah, and one thing I can certainly say is that the Yidinji Nation certainly doesn't have annual celebrations or commemorations for wars done 500 years ago, 300 years ago, or, you know, those types of things. So it is a very much a European because they had so many, I guess, in Europe, you know, 1066, Battle of Hastings, you can go, like, and it's written in the Bible, all these, you know, all these wars as well. So it is part of that life, I guess, that world. But here, I think peace and security is very much the consistent theme of the Yidinji Nation.
It really is, you know, the civility, I suppose, of the Aboriginal nations far, far exceeds the civility of the Western world, the collective Western world, when I say that, because most of these wars and these arguments, this plundering was all over resources. They had to come and plunder the stuff that we had here, the timbers, for example, you know, that made up Old Parliament House. Where did they come from? They come out of the rainforest of the Aboriginal people's, you know, homeland. There's timber down in Old Parliament House from here, from this very country here. Did they ask for it? Did they have the right to take it? Did they pay for it? You know, there was none of that. No to that, all of that. They didn't have the right to take it. They didn't pay for it. Did they plunder it? Blimey, they did. And they come here looking for resources. That's all the world was over. Now, there was a really rather interesting article in The Guardian recently, the Guardian UK, where a woman got up. She's of African descent, I think it is. You can see the colour of her skin was very dark. And she said that the colonial empire, the British colonial empire, did not profit from, you know, the resources of these indigenous nations around the world. Well, you know, I beg to stand differ, you know, to with this here, that what did we have? We had all the resources, the timber, the gold, the farmland, you know, all this, where did it all go? We went back to the homeland, because Great Britain is only a very small place. It's only islands, really, compared to us. So where did all their gold come from when they don't have huge reserves of gold, you know, and yet Australia does? Where did all this timber come from, you know, when they cut all theirs down and burned it? You know, their timber in the last few centuries had come from places like here. Where did sugar come from, you know, if it didn't come from places like here?
Where did all their criminals go?
Oh, they sent the criminals here. Oh, geez, I think they're running Parliament. No, look, in all honesty, the empire did plunder all. That's what the empire was about. The colonial empire was to go out and reach out across the world to take all the resources back home to the motherland. And, you know, the British Empire, believe it or not, was one of the biggest empires globally. And then there was that old saying, the sun never sets on the empire. That's how widespread it was. You know, globally, it was right around the globe, so the sun never ever set on the empire. It was always some place in the empire that had that was daytime. So, but they did take all our resources. Did they have the right to do it? No. And how'd they do it? By sending out their blokes with guns, you know, and the guns that shot people, the poison that they used, you know, the disease that they purposely brought to the Aboriginal people who weren't immune to such things as smallpox and that. You know, the old saying, pox-ridden blankets. They give you blankets, but, you know, they were designed to kill you. You know, lucky that the genocide that they perpetrated, you know, was not, you know... if it was done now, well, I don't know the way the world's going, that if it was done now, it should have been recorded, well recorded, and people would be getting hung for it, you know. The atrocities were terrible.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, this statement that Gagnon's talking about, this is still a colonised, this is one of the colonies. What's changed? You know, the Australian is not some independent of England, of Britain. It is still a colony over there. It is still acts that way. It still treats the people with no, the people who own the country, the original people, have no rights in their own country. And they're treated as they were when things were colonised.
Yes, it's one of those things where it is a derivative, to the point where the Australian flag clearly identifies the Union Jack. If you go to the local diocese, they've got the diocese flag there with the Union Jack. Hanging down there very, very proudly inside the big building in the city of Ghimoy there. So, you know, it certainly has a European flavour, whereas the Yidinchi flag is from here, and the government represents this territory. We're not interested in conquesting or overtaking other peoples or usurping their sovereignty. But I don't think we're that insecure, to be fair. We've got everything we need here. We've got the men and women. We've got the water, the resources, the land, the rainforest, the reef, you name it. You can't get a better place on earth than here.
Well, I don't think you can, to be quite honest. It's very clean. It's halfway to Asia compared to Sydney, for example. We got the lifestyle. It really is good. You're going to get the rain every year. We're going to get the drier time, the cooler time. It is heaven on earth here. But in saying that, we're here to share it with the Australians that are here as well. And the only way we can do that properly is through a formal agreement, a treaty, a negotiated settlement, if you want, you know. But there's going to be terms and conditions on that. And the only way we can do this, to settle this past of these so-called alleged frontier wars, which we call massacres and genocide, which the world would actually call that as well, the only way to let the Australians be here is through a formally negotiated settlement where there's a power-sharing arrangement in place, because remember, there's coexisting sovereignties. There's the sovereignty of Australia for all the Australian people, and then there's our sovereignty that hasn't been ceded or extinguished and hasn't been obtained by conquest, you know, or gotten rid of by conquest. We're here.
It's going to be interesting. I see that a number of nations now have come out to recognise a Palestinian state, Spain, Barbados, for example, the recent one, at least. And it's if they're recognising Palestine and Israel, then Yidinji's not too far away, considering that there is no treaty here. The world has agreed to decolonise. So, you know, these things now, it would be hypocritical, I think, or inconsistent that Palestine gets recognition but the Yidinji nation doesn't.
Well, you know, there's horses for courses, and we've got some theories and thoughts on all of it ourselves. The one that I prefer is to we'll do a treaty with Australia and appoint it to represent us at the international level, at the UN. You know, do we have the resources to make the equivalent of a Palestinian state, you know, where we are the boss?
Yeah, but the question is, I mean, we've offered this for 10 years now. They don't want to engage, so maybe it's time to move on.
Oh, we got every right to move on and then start to build the Yidinji state to go forward into the UN. Now, it's been well recorded by a number of constitutional experts, which is very important, not us. This is not us saying it, but we've got constitutional experts saying that we can form the state that we need, you know, not just be a micro state, but we'll be an active state and take membership or request membership within the United Nations, which is every right. We've got every right to do that because we have the sovereignty that's been unseated. And listen, when it comes back to sovereignty, if it's unseated and the British can't prove how they got sovereignty over here, there's the old Roman saying, "Iudi posse deitis." It goes back to those who had it first. Until the decision is made how they got here and how they obtained the whole lot, maybe it belongs to the original owners.
Yes, indeed. And I think, you know, even similar to Taiwan or the Vatican, who knows, the future might be, for Yidinji, maybe one of those types of models where they're sort of non-voting UN observers type thing. You know, I don't really want to be part of the United Nations, to be fair. I think it's struggling with the task it's taken on, and you sort of don't want to be even hit by friendly fire, which is quite likely to happen when you look at the what's going on around the world. But Yerulam, this is where we like to focus on what we're doing here, and you know, either way, Australia come to the table or someone else will come to the table if Australia doesn't, and I'm not so sure of what's going to happen, but I know it will happen.
Yeah, of course. You know, like it's been an incredible challenge in certain ways for us to say no to the many offers we've already had of treating with other nations throughout the world. You know, there is an enormous amount of interest in Yidinji from that perspective, and yet, you know, it's incredible, and it's a resilience or a representation of the cultural ways to look after the people that are here. That's sort of the only reason that it hasn't happened so far, because the interest is looking after the people who aren't Yidinji citizens. You know, we look after our own citizens quite well, but there's many people on our country that aren't Yidinji citizens, and that's a concern for us. That's a concern culturally and administratively. So, you know, but it is hard to continue down that path when the people who invaded the Yidinji nation aren't willing to come to the table.
Yeah, and, you know, these belligerent non-resident, non-citizens, let's say, are here. And we're not talking about the men and women, obviously. We're talking about the pieces of paper. But I really think that the private sector is the one that might really break the mould, Ganyara. So, like, Australian companies that spruik this Indigenous-friendly, Indigenous-rights type of setup, maybe they will be the ones to actually just bite the bullet and the government maybe, you know, either reel them in or just let it happen. But ultimately, we don't know how it's going to pan out, but you'd hope. But like I said, it's a bit of a punch in the pants that for the last few years, since 2017 at least, it's been very, very difficult to get an audience with certain executive members of the Commonwealth of Australia, for example.
Yeah, it has been a challenge over the period, but I'm in very early talks with a number of people from possibly some of the biggest mining companies in Australia regarding this very issue of, you know, have they got the right to take out the resources, the iron ore, the coal, the gold that belongs to someone else, you know, and it doesn't belong to Australia. And that was said actually by Julia Gillard back in 2012, that at the miners' meeting that she said, we hold this land in you know, in trust for sovereign people. And we actually wrote off to her and said, okay, who are these sovereign people? Do you mean us or do you mean the Australians? Because the Australians are only belligerent occupants. They have no right to be here based on the foundation of the Commonwealth of Australia, you know, and it's based on Britain's alleged claim. And I'll use the word alleged claim to speak for all this country, because that's all it is. Where it's very clearly coming out now that by the constitutional experts that Australia doesn't have much of a leg to stand on. And the British claim to here was very, very built on quicksand. It was fragile, to say the least. But these mining companies might be a little bit worried about what they've actually done when you read Article 28 of the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People. Give it back or pay for it all. And have the Aboriginal people been paid for what's been plundered from them? Think about that, you know, especially the bigger mining companies. They need to understand this. They might have to pay all over again.
Yeah, and those things need to be disclosed to the shareholders and the majority shareholders. That may be something that, like I said, may cause a few issues for the federal executive. But ultimately, that shouldn't be the reason for wanting a Yidinji settlement, for example, or a successfully negotiated agreement with us. It's not about whacking people over the head with a stick, whether it's financial or legal or whatever it is. It's quite a simple thing, in that I think as men of honour, the Yidinji elders have come with this solution that is win-win. I can't see it any other way.
Australia worry that they're going to lose some control over the Aboriginal people who they've bashed for so long, and they just take it as their foregone conclusion that they can just keep bashing them forever and a day. They can't. That this is coming to an end. It really will come to an end, and they will lose some of that grip over the Aboriginal people. They just can't bash them anymore. This is the end times for Australia with that authoritarian control over Aboriginal, putting them in missions and just hoping that they die and go away, and that the hand of God acts upon them with disease and pestilence, for example. You know, those days are over. It's just now coming to the day of realisation that we're here, we're trying to offer the right thing, we're trying to do the right thing by Australia, and it's up to them now to grasp it with both hands.
Yirrlum, that's one of the things we've often talked about here, is, you know, there's a spiritual implication or a spiritual game that's going on in the background. And in good faith, Yidinji's trying to be the one that's, like I said, acting in honour and in good faith. But, you know, like I said, there's a lot of goodwill inside of Australia in terms of the people. And that's where the hearts and minds game is really important. A lot of people that come into this office want truth and want peace. And that's a very important thing that we're promoting here.
Yeah, well, you know, how simple is it from that perspective? You know, from the spiritual nature, that is the essence of all of our beings. And whether the opposing forces, whether it be a governments on this continent or anywhere else, only want to see it from the power perspective and only want to deal in violence, they're going down a path that will only lose and only head in the wrong direction for them. So, yeah, Yidinji continues to be, as it's always been, loving, accepting and wanting to find a way forward peacefully.
Got the frontier wars happening today, that being Wednesday, and joining me now are some of the movers and groovers behind the actual event organising, and very much part of the Yidinji fabric, and that's Miriam, Patricia and Margaret in the studio. And ladies, thank you so much for your time today. Margaret, I might start with you because obviously I've known you for a long time. You're a big supporter of Indigenous rights, but tell us a little bit about the Frontier Wars event. How did it start? Where did it start? And how did it come to Ghimoy Cairns area?
Yeah, this is our 90th year this year, Murumu. It's very That's exciting. Amazing. And it's great to be here on Yidinji territory. And the way it started was just making friends with people, really, you know, like making friends with some of the seniors in some of the clans, especially the clan, the Gimoi Wallaburra Yidinji clan, and having conversations about what type of truth-telling was necessary at that time. So that was about 2015, 2016. And at that time, you know, the words frontier wars weren't being used a lot. And if you use them on Facebook, you know, the white fellas from out the back of the country there, they'd have a good go at you. Go, oh, there are no frontier wars here. That's the Americas. But, you know, the Yidinji told us, no, they wanted to talk about war. They wanted to talk about war and not just massacres either, because massacres were occurred at different points of time on country. But it was they wanted to talk about that sort of resistance, how there was an organised resistance and the clans joined together to resist the settler colonial society. And, you know, like even thinking about it 8 years down the track, we've got much more words. We can talk about it better. We didn't even talk about settler colonial society back there that much.
Well, I think it's changed the narrative inside of Australia, for example. People are talking a lot about, well, they did about The Voice and obviously the frontier stories from around the continent is really important. Treaty, Indigenous rights. And I would say that, you know, anyone I've met, whether doesn't matter about their political opinion, people are really hungry for truth and justice. It doesn't matter if you're vote Conservative or Labor. People want what's fair, and I think that is a really important thing to consider. But, I mean, Patricia, why did you get involved and how did you get involved with the events here in Gimoi?
Well, I was part of a group here called Peace Pilgrims, Peace by Peace Group, and we started with that. And I thought it was important. I was teaching in some schools with Indigenous kids and started recognising some of the names and their connections, either Yarrabah, Mossman, Cooktown, Torres Strait. And then when this happened, I thought we were trying to teach some Indigenous history in schools and it was lacking. So I thought this was a way to join in and educate myself and, as Margaret said, make relationships with some of the women elders in particular.
And how's that working out for you personally? I mean, obviously it's an important job, but what are some of the people who may never have heard about this, what are they coming back to you with feedback? What kind of feedback are you receiving?
So there are a few of my friends who know I've been doing it now. This is the 9th year. I've pulled them into it and they're keen to come. Some are Indigenous women from other areas. Some are friends I've had here for years and didn't even know about it, and that the Gimoi, Wallaburra, Yidinji, the women elders in particular, were taking the lead in this and telling their stories. So those women in particular have embraced us, and they're supporting us this year by attending and, you know, bringing food or flowers or whatever. So some are younger, some are older. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. And Miriam, I might bring you in here. Obviously, Patricia just mentioned food and cultural things. And one of the things I find moving and that I love about the event is that there are traditional performances, and there's also performances from people like yourself who do dancing, and you know, that is something that really, when we're talking about truth and justice at the core of the human soul and whatnot, but human like movement is also part of what we do, and you know, promoting that idea as a medium to share the pain or the story, all that kind of thing is an amazing thing in itself as well.
Yeah, from my story is a lot like Patricia's, because I was a teacher and teaching in different kinds of schools and meeting children and their parents and communities. And as far as our response at these events, it's almost something that's beyond words for us to have a response or lament in response to the stories we hear. And doing that through dance and through through music is a way that we can find to make a response that feels right and appropriate. Because the words, there's so much to say, and there's almost impossible to say how we feel in response to hearing those stories. And some just one thing that I became aware of recently by talking to Margaret and hearing the stories of people who were displaced and so ended up here, and that colonial project was also about displacing people and moving people and herding people into different parts of the country. So, how can you respond to that? So responding to that through movement is, for me, a way that I can do that, you know, respectfully and,
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's all part of the healing journey, I guess, because, you know, these are shared stories. It's not exclusively one side or a side, let's say. And Margaret, I'll bring you back into the conversation because I know that, you know, everyone has a different, like, journey up until this point in the history of the world, let's say, as four souls, living souls here. And everyone has a unique and different background, and no one's is ever the same. But I think, once again, coming back, we want the same. We want that remedy, that trauma. We want to heal, settle the past and secure the future for the generations to come. But that needs to take... governments can't do that. They're limited to doing certain things. They can make decrees and laws, but ultimately it comes down to the what I would describe as a good faith by the men and women that live here, that live together for whatever reason, whether they've historically been displaced or they made a choice to move here or they were born here for generations.
Yeah, and I think we've seen, you know, with the yes vote last year, you know, that there's, you know, we really haven't come as far as we thought we had come in terms of right relationships with Aboriginal people. And that truth-telling, what we call people-to-people truth-telling is so important because the government really, you know, it's got a lot of resources and has done very little to enable the most basic of truth-telling. And that storytelling can be done culturally. And this is what you'll find if you come to our event, is that it is not flash in any way and it's not professional. It's truly a Frontier Wars truth-telling ceremony between the Yidinji and between those of us who have lived on this territory for many years. And not only have we lived on this territory, but our families have lived in Queensland for many years, on different territories in Queensland. And so we want to make right relationship. We want to make sure that that we build the future on right relationships. So that is, you know, the Yidinji have a right relationship with the country, and we can only have that relationship if we are in relationship with Yidinji. There's no point in us trying to have relationship with country without going through our relationships with Yidinji in some sort of way. And obviously we can't all have an individual personal relationship with Yidinji, but we can do it ceremonially and have that relation ceremonially. And so I think in that ceremonial relationship, you have the foundation of both interpersonal healing, interpersonal understanding and growth, but you also then have a chance for cultural and structural setting up cultural and structural right relationship, which you can't do without some sort of without some sort of ceremony, I think, at that base level. So we really invite people to come. We invite non-Indigenous people to come, and we invite people to set up their own truth-telling ceremonies in their own places.
Thank you for that. The other thing, obviously, I've noticed that you guys are teachers and counsellors, and these themes are running quite consistently through the message today. It is about healing and learning, and it's also good for, I think, for Yidinji to hear the stories, because that's where connections are made. For example, you know, I think there's a somewhat of a guilt that people feel sometimes, I think, and sometimes they don't know how to address that. And I think from the Yidinji point of view, it's not about, it's like, well, how about we just, you're one of us, and, you know, let's just share that rather than feeling guilty and thinking that maybe it's never going to go away. Because obviously, you know, when we talk about love as a principle and not as an emotion, for example, these things can conquer that, these past wrongs and things like that. And it's the only thing that can. So my thing comes back to what's one of the most touching moments that you've either, you can share if you want to or not, but that's something that's happened to you at the event or even after the event because of a connection you made from Frontier?
Yeah, I might have a go. So last year we held our ceremony and it was raining, like this year it's raining. And so where we held it was in a space that was much confined and there weren't as many people because of the rain. But at that, in response to the stories that Auntie Elaine and Auntie Teresa tell and that Henrietta tells in the story that we play for everyone as they're assembling, I had a response, and it took me 8 years to be able to respond in public, that over those years I've had a connection particularly with Auntie Elaine and we have a similar sense of humour. So she's the one who I've connected with as a person, as a mature-aged woman. So that was a bit of an insight for me last year, that it took me quite a while to be able to say what I felt and the great connection that I now had with the individuals and not just with the story.
Yeah, I was just thinking in respect of how we commemorate or remember, and we've got these formal ways of doing that for some events, for example, for Anzac Day and so on. So the idea that we could have these opportunities that communities set up for us to remember together and talk together. You know, ceremonial rituals that become part of the fabric of what we do here on this country, so that people have the opportunity to come into that space, even though they might not know somebody personally and have a relationship, and start to make that a very normal thing that we do together at whatever the time of year is. And in this case of Cairns, I know in other parts it's done in different places, but that it's normal. It's normalised. It's comfortable. You can be invited in. You can come in. You can hear stories, and you can meet people, and set this thing up that young children can learn about. We learn about these things, you know, Anzac Day and so on, but we haven't had a way to do that as communities before. So that's I think the wonderful thing about Frontier War Ceremony here, you know, 9 years, that's pretty formidable, really.
It is, and it's like I said, it's if you can get down tonight, Margaret, if you can remind us of the details.
Yeah, we're down at the port. Actually, Trish is probably the best person. Down at the port at Wharf 1 if it's raining, down the end of the port building if it's not raining.
Yeah, near Thancoopy's big spherical ball, that park there, which has a lot of story already invested in it, and it is a gathering space. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how we're going to start till we get there, but we will.
That's the southern end of the wharf.
The southern mm-hmm. end, yeah, where it says Cairns Cruise Liner Wharf. Mm-hmm. So down there. So we're gathering from 5 for a start around 6.
And I've got a story. I want to tell one story too before we finish. Is that all right? Because there's two things that really stand out for me in terms of moments. One is the very first, again, Elaine and Teresa turned up. Teresa turned up at the first one with a beautiful lament. that they sing the Yidinji prayer, that they sing a prayer of lament, and they came that first year with that lament and brought that and have sung it every year since. And the you know, just hearing them that first year was just astounding, because they totally understood what had been envisaged by the leadership. So the Yidinji leadership is so important. And then watching all the leadership come in other years from the different clans and supporting that event has been amazing. But the other event, I think, which is where you get to see how ceremony changes us and changes the world, is the year that those elders laid a wreath for the Frontier Wars at the Anzac Day event the next day, and that where there was an acknowledgement of the Frontier Wars sort of as part of the Anzac Day event, and that occurred sort of culturally and not necessarily through other means, just because had become so important to people that it needed to happen, and people made it happen, because the Frontier Wars really are the only wars that occurred on this country, and they occurred because our people, our settler colonial people, came and they harmed Aboriginal people. They seriously harmed Aboriginal people and First Nations people and destroyed communities and cultures. And that's really the one war we need to discuss, that we share from both sides, and it's the one that really shapes our society in the most significant way. And so to put that in the middle of that war commemoration and truth-telling ceremony that occurs on Anzac Day was very, very important, I think.
And I must say that there's a fine line between... It's like anything. If you raise the subject matter, right, in this case, the harm and the injury that was caused, it can be a triggering event if there's no remedy in sight. So you can talk about things, and these things are always there, and they might actually create more trauma. And what I like about this event that we're talking about today is that there is hope, and there is love, and there is a remedy. And that's, you know, when we look at from a Yidinji government point of view, it's about hearts and minds, right? How can you get the very worst of your enemy to sit down? Let's say, not that we have enemies here, but I'm just saying in a philosophical way, how could you get someone who's the most hardened of heart, who thinks it didn't happen, who doesn't want anything to be done, I don't want to give them any money or anything like that, how do you get them to sit down at this event? Or through a third party, they talk to this particular people or individual about that and how it's not really threatening at all. It's about... moving forward together.
Yeah, well, I think the idea is to build an imagination, and one of the things that, you know, extreme violence does is wipe people's imaginations for the future, because all you can do is survive and, you know, and be grateful for survival. But what we need to really do is build an imagination for a future together. And I think the Yidinji sovereign Yidinji government offers us a way forward, and this sort of the idea of returning to right relationship, returning to right sovereignty, and then building treaty out of right relationship. You know, it's almost like we have to go back in time and re-establish right relationship and then re-establish a future together. And but we do need to do that together. It can't just be done in an office like here or with the government, you know, or with Michael Healy's office or something like that. You know, like, it has to be done through a collective expression and a collective imagination. And I think we saw that with the yes vote, is that we still have no collective imagination of what that will mean, that there's a whole group of people who just got no clue in their minds. All they can imagine is separation. Well, we don't. We imagine, we know the Yidinji imagine it, and there's a group of us here, settler colonial background, who also have an imagination for the future about how we can live together and be together.
And Patricia, I'll bring you in back in again. The link to Anzac may be the way that this moves forward, because obviously remembering loss and hurt and these things, they are connected in some ways. And that's how I think when you find the common denominator to certain things, that people actually sharing stuff, this is a very important way of maybe conveying this message about what the Frontier Wars is all about.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things that Auntie Teresa and Auntie Elaine do is they have a wreath which they bring to today, Wednesday's ceremony, and it's there for us to look at. And then the next morning they go to the early dawn service, I think, and they lay the wreath at the cenotaph on the esplanade. And so that's a really good connection for us. Sometimes we've had people talk about that connection, that they've had uncles or grandfathers or great-grandfathers who've been in the wars. And so that sparks their interest in finding out. In Cairns here, in fact, you can see it on the Esplanade and Trinity Beach, where some of the World War II soldiers in the AIF trained here, or they trained up on the Tablelands. So there is a connection for that as well. But the way the aunties bring the wreath and then move it from the Wednesday afternoon to the Thursday morning, I think is a pretty powerful symbol of saying everyone mourns, and here's our wreath that shows our mourning for everyone.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I'm coming back to the... Obviously, this is something that is happening for the last number of years now, 8 years. This is the ninth year. I mean, you talk about imaginations before, Margaret. What do you envisage, or what do you want for the future? Like, this is, like, let's say, 10 years from now. Mm. we might be here, we may not be here, but the point being is that there will be people that take this on and move forward with it. And, you know, around the country and the nation, the continent, they're happening. I know that there have been events that have come to life in different places. But how do you see this running? Miriam, I'll get you to start.
It's a big question, but I think that two things...
Well, what do you want, actually?
What do I want? If we as communities become better at telling stories, we haven't been very good at that, and telling also implies listening to other stories, so this becomes a part of our culture, and hopefully and Margaret talks about this, what Margaret was talking about before, that we start to build an imagination of what it might have been like, so we kind of have to backtrack. And this idea that and I don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but the idea that we, the people, together with the sovereign governments, could start to find a way to build this new future that we want, the one that probably should have been in place. So it's going to be, I guess it's going to be a lot of hard work, and I don't exactly know what it would look like. But maybe it's all about a process of starting towards that possibility. What I would hope it to be like is I want to come into Cairns, you know, if I'm coming into Cairns, I want that the name to be there. I want people to understand what country they're coming onto and deal directly with the sovereign government. That would be one small example of that.
Patricia?
I suppose it's spreading the Allies group and getting support from more people. So I know there's people who are interested, and it's tricky getting those people together. So my vision would be that we expand the group here and it becomes a bit more cohesive and... just moves from year to year to join with the women elders and have the event going. So it'll be around capacity building in both groups.
I think what's important is the people-to-people truth-telling and ceremonialising that. It's been happening around Australia. There's a number of examples. Mostly it takes quite a lot of skill, but I'm trying to think about ways that it can be quite simple, because it really needs to happen in every place, in every nation, wherever there are relationships, where a few people with close relationships bring people into those relationships, sort of bring trusted people into those relationships. And so you see it in Mile Creek,
there was a group that set up there, and then they set up a beautiful memorial, sort of a memorial that you can visit. But then they also do a ceremony there every year. Appin, down in the southern part of Sydney, again, they have a big event every year. 500 people go in Sydney now. So they've built it to that size. And then they have... But again, they have other sort of ways of representing the truth telling. They're scattered around the country. It's One Tree Hill. So what I would like to see is people, you know, is non-Indigenous people making an offering to the people they have relationships with, the Aboriginal people they have relationships, for small truth-telling events, and that they ceremonialise those truth-telling events, because what that allows is to bring a lot of people in to be part of the relationship without Aboriginal people having to do a lot of work to be friends with everybody. You know, everyone wants an Aboriginal friend, right? And so, but if you can ceremonialise it through a couple of relationships and a couple of close contacts, you can have you can have a sense of being in relationship without First Nations people having to maintain a whole lot of annoying white friends.
Yeah, I think it's really important. You've hit the nail on the head there. It's heartfelt, right? This is the, you know, and with no disrespect to Anzac, and obviously I know and we have family members who fought and served. But you wouldn't want Frontier War cookies, and you wouldn't want to have to trademark that and protect the brand, because it's become so, whatever it is, fear of commercialising.
Yeah, and we're not a performance. Or we're not a performance either, right? And so they actually have had better performances than ours here. Like, there's been some beautiful truth-telling performances here that have been arranged by professional production teams. Mm. And they have been excellent part of festivals and stuff. Mm. And but we are not that. We are just people-to-people truth-telling. Mm. And those things should happen as well, but they're not this.
Mm. Yeah, very much so. It's not entertainment.
It's not entertainment.
Then, you know, this is about really, you know, when I hear about people going to Turkey, for example, because their grandfather fought there or whatever it is, that's beautiful because it's part of their story. But this land is also part of their story.
Yeah.
And wherever they are, you know, you're walking on that country. And so, as we've mentioned it before, imagine courting a lady or a friend or whatnot with the intention of, you know, marriage and other things, but not knowing her middle name.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. This place has a name.
Yeah.
What's the intimate name? What's the... How do you liaise with that? Then this is one of the events where, you know, you can do that in a safe environment, mind you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can be brought into a relationship with Gimoi and into a relationship with the Yidinji. And I think, you know, if you look at the years where it's gone really well, actually we were supported by professional performance artists from
directors
who were working here at that stage at the Southern Cross University.
Yeah.
And those people just served us really as a community to bring some skill and help us make it better, right? Because we did use a little bit of professional skill to help that, you know.
That's not a sin. I mean,
it was really good. That was a really good way of doing it. And what we would like to see is, you know, professional, you know, curators and producers just supporting small community-based events, because we do need those people, because they notice things like, oh, you can't see because it's too dark.
And no worries. Well, that's the end of this particular session, ladies. I really appreciate the caliber of your contribution over the last nearly 10 years to this city and to the tribe. It's a very important role, you know, it can't be measured. To be fair, these things have a value of that's untouchable. And just to confirm, it's 5 p.m. tonight at Wharf One.
Yep.
And if it's raining, we'll go down to the southern part of the wharf. Where,
the northern part.
Yeah, other way around. If it's raining, we'll go to Wharf One. And if it's not raining, we'll be down at the southern part.
Thank you. Before we head off, Yirlum and Ganyara, some final comments. Yirlum, we'll start with you.
No, once again, the same message. You know, every other nation on this continent has got the capacity and the legal right to develop their nation, their government, and act accordingly. And as always, Yidinji welcomes and extends every bit of help that we can.
Yeah, let's get the terminology right. You know, if we're going to call it a war, give us the declaration of war, give us the declaration of peace. Otherwise, call it for what it really is. Genocide, massacre, murder. You know, by the boat people that come here, there's roughly 25 million boat people. Get them to get it right, get the terminology right, describe it for what it is. And, you know, the truth commissions that are going on, like the Europe Truth Commission down